Yes, of course. Burl Bearer. I've known a few writers who were rogues and vagabonds. And I'm Roger Moore. I didn't supply the microphone.
Live from the gleaming, streamlined, state-of-the-art studios of OutlawRadioLive.com, here's Howard's favorite word, nestled in our secret bunker somewhere in the Los Angeles area. Following program is produced by Magic Matt Allen on the Outlaw Radio Network.
When is the last time in any context you've used that word?
Nestled? I use it every week.
Yeah, that was last week, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, Matt.
But in the same context.
Yeah, that's the only time anybody uses it.
Well, if you happen to be a bird watcher.
What?
Oh, God, spare me.
Well, you.
I am the legendary Burl Bear under more pressure than an astronaut. The man right there is Howard Lapidus, manager of the Star.
Yes, I am.
The guy over here whose voice I cannot understand because I have no treble frequencies in my audio processing.
My sincere apologies.
I think he said that he's sincerely apologetic.
Yes, he is.
Or apoplectic.
I'm not, though. I can't hear him either.
No. Thank God.
And it's good, isn't it? That helps you guys out.
Meanwhile, when I was a kid, we used to have this thing in school where it was like, bring your parents to school day and they'd say what they did for a living. Like, yeah, here's my mom. She's a hooker. Or, you know, what do you do if your parent has an embarrassing gig? There was a Billy Crystal movie where he shows up and tries to explain selling airtime, which I always thought was fascinating. What do you do if you're going to a very expensive boarding school, right? Like the most expensive one in the world. And the kids there, let's say like you're 10, 11 years old, and the other kids there are the sons of diplomats, daughters of princes and Saudi Arabian hoo-has. And your dad is an international thief. How do you explain? Well, our guest today went to that boarding school. He actually taught Roger Moore how to ski while he was there.
But was your father a thief?
My father wasn't, but his father was. Punch, check in, please.
Hello, guys.
Hi there. So there you were, minding your own business, being a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid in Switzerland at the most expensive boarding school in the world. At that time, it was over $100,000 a year. This is back when $100,000 was $100,000. And these are the creme de la creme of international wealth. And they go, hey, Paul, they say, what does your dad do for a living?
Yeah, that was really fun. That was an experience, guys. Let me tell you, there's nothing nicer in the world than pretending, you know, pretending to be somebody else. And we all celebrate Halloween in America, right?
So, yeah.
You know, and people want to be somebody else. My father, he pretended to play the role that I said he was, which was a legitimate businessman, you know, a jeweler, you know, in New York. And, you know, when he came to visit me, he pulled up in the big 560 SEL, you know, Mercedes, and, he put a show on. It was really nice. I enjoyed it.
Well, yeah, I've talked to some of your schoolmates who said, oh, yeah, his dad came, and, boy, was he sweet and charming and entertaining,
yeah.
And just a wonderful guy, some sort of a wealthy jeweler in New York City.
Exactly. If they only knew the truth behind it all. Yeah, this is a big move for him. You know, and for myself being exposed, you know, with other children and you know, a different country, different laws, and here I am. 12, 13, 14 years old in a boarding school, while I know my father is this notorious jewel thief in New York City. Yeah, that was a strange time.
Yeah, I would imagine so. I mean, it must have been a time where you found out what your dad really did for a living. I think someone finally took you aside and said, "Kid, let me tell you what your dad does."
Yeah, it was Alex Gribbets, the moth, Moya. this guy, he, when I was like 7 years old, I believe, he straight up just opened up and said, you know, your father's a thief, right? And I was like, what do you mean? We're all thieves, he said. Everybody. And, you know, he was honest. And, you know, you're supposed to be honest with somebody. That you're not supposed to hide it. And
what was your reaction to that?
Well, I always kind of knew. Well, they made it cool. You know, they made it cool. And there were some cool cats. You know, so I emulated them immediately. I wanted to be like them. You know, it's like any kid growing up in Bensonhurst. And, you know, they see mobsters, you know, growing up in that lifestyle. It's the same thing. You know, you get attracted to that lifestyle, and once the truth is exposed, you love it even more. You accept it. You know.
Now, from what I understand, when the crews would get ready to go do a big heist when you were a kid,
yeah,
you found that very exciting. You'd help them get ready, check the batteries and the flashlights and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, this was my job. I had to prepare everything. You know, I had to put gloves on, use alcohol, and I wiped down the tools, you know, from all the fingerprints, and take off all the tags if it was purchased in a hardware store or whatever. And you get rid of all that evidence and pack it up. So, yeah, I was trained at a very young age to do that. And as a coffee boy, an errand boy, I used to make the best coffee. I was really fast, quick. You know, to make the coffee. And every time I brought the coffee, I would get, you know, $20, $50, $100, a gold chain, you know.
$500,000 ring.
Yeah. You know, yeah, they stuffed my pockets because I was the only kid growing up in this, you know. So I was the only child. I didn't have any other friends. Well, I did have other friends, but they didn't know what was going on. I knew what was going on. And I grew up in this lifestyle. Everything was at my house. You know, the entire show was always at my house. After every score, they would tally up, you know, divvy up all the swag, the stuff, the diamonds and jewelry that they got. They would divide everything. And it would be usually my father, the person that would sell everything, you know. So he would pay everyone. It would be his job, his heist, his crew. You know, guys worked for him, basically. And a lot of these guys, once they learned how to, you know, once they learned the ropes, they could have broke off and started their own crews, you know, and that's exactly what they did.
One thing I find, many things I find fascinating about your story is that, you know, you think about someone doing a diamond heist in the Diamond District in New York, you figure they come in from somewhere else, hit it, leave, try to get out of the country, God knows what. But the brilliance, yeah. The brilliance, I think, from a criminal standpoint of your father, is that he had at least five offices in the Diamond District running what appeared to be perfectly reputable businesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, not only that, we had keys to another 10 or 12 locations. So you could just imagine the magnitude of this. It wasn't just that one street. The entire Manhattan, basically. It was everything. Everything. Anything of value.
So your dad, remember I was listening to one of the interviews with him that he did on the sly there, you know, for future reference?
Yeah.
That he didn't start off doing diamonds.
No, he started off with this master criminal, Alex Karolanovich. Alex. We call him Texas. And he was one of the original members that got arrested for the Vizcaya, you know, in the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the guy that owned the cab stand, whatever. He had his own cab company, his own medallion. And he started out stealing. He was the real, like, real thief, you know, that came from this communist country, right? And he and my father, they started playing chess together, you know, and then they met Polish. The Polish guy, Andre Montrose, master criminal. And these guys, you know, they used to go to museums and I guess bag chicks or something. You know, I guess that's where they used to go. And, you know, they used to impress, I guess, the females because they knew about the art and, you know, they studied, they knew, you know, they knew who the artists were, if it was a Monet or Manet, you know. They had some general knowledge about artwork and antiques because they were, you know, they were future thieves, basically, you know. They were, you know, my father was a thief in training, and these guys were already seasoned vets as far as being thieves. They were thieves in Europe. And when they came here, they got together with my father, and they started banging out, like, galleries, antique stores, you know, things of that nature. A lot of silver in the 70s. Silver was expensive. It wasn't what it was today, you know.
Yeah, the Hunt brothers screwed up that market.
Right, right. So, you know, silver was extremely expensive in the 70s and 80s, and then the price just plummeted. And it never went back up. But no matter, my father switched to gold then after. You know, as a matter of fact, one of his first nicknames was Stan Silver, or Lucky Stan. You know, he just had a streak of good luck. You know, this guy, he had a streak of good women, you know, in his life. He had fast cars. You know, he really lived a life. The guy had it all. I mean, you know, he had restaurants, he had nightclubs, he had jewelry stores, and he had a lot of real estate.
But so he really didn't need. And my mother. He really didn't need to do heist after a while because he had all these real businesses.
He didn't have to do heist since I was born. He didn't have to do heist. I was born very extremely wealthy, very rich. But you know, he was hooked on the actual, you know, the heist, the doing it. The accomplishment. It wasn't the money. It never was the money. You know, it never was the money. It was, you know, being that he was a chess player and he was good at figuring things out. And he just seen what it was that it just, you know, places weren't secured as they were supposed to be secured. And there's a reason for it. My father used to always tell me, he's like, look, son, if you don't think that this is all corrupt, let me explain something to you. He says, do you see they have glass? You know, a window, and then they put a gate over the glass. You know, is why don't they put the gate behind the glass?
That never occurred to me.
You see, that's how he thinks, and this is why.
That's amazing. You know, stop to think about it. Yeah, that really is amazing.
Yeah. So you see what I mean now? So this is the way he thought. And this is the way I learned that if it ever said something like, do not enter private, to me that means, you know, look, please search, you know. you know,
I'm still thinking about the gate with the glass. Why is it on the other side?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. You know, and so their methods of stealing were purely fascinating due to the fact that they used physical endurance because they were athletes, so they used to climb like, you know, 10, 15 floors on a rope, you know, and no cops could do that, you know what I mean? They're always going to follow you up a rope. I mean, you know, so, you had to be in such shape. And I was just getting a story from Alex a few days ago. We were communicating, and he was telling me. We were asking about this Croatian fellow that was a professional soccer player, but he wanted to do a heist, you know, so he can retire, you know, and you know, with a lot of money and go back to his country, and which he did. But when he went on the heist with Alex, both Alexes were at this heist. This was Alex Gerbat and Alex Vucic. That's Montenegro. And these two guys, they climbed like, you know, three, four floors on a rope with knots on it. Mm-hmm. And this guy that was a professional athlete couldn't do it. He was frozen. He was stuck out of fear. Like, he was just frozen. He couldn't move.
He was
like a statue. And they had to carry him. They had to carry this guy. That's how frozen this guy was out of fear. You know, because people think they can do this, you know. But then there's an illegal element. And that's like, you know, some people have stage fright.
Yeah.
Some people are so talented. I'm not joking. I met so many talented people in prison, for example, that sing in their cells, right? Mm-hmm. And nobody can see them singing, but you could hear it. But they would never sing in front of you because they're scared. You know, they don't have, they have fear. They're stage fright. You know, they have, a lot of people have, a lot of people go through this. And, I mean, do you understand? Like, I'm explaining to you what it takes to become a thief. You know, it's not just you being a strong guy or smart. Or, no, it's something extra. You need something more, you know? And it's not necessarily bad. It's just that you have to have this no fear aspect about, you know, when you're doing something like this. You can't think about anything negative. You can't think about, you know, but you have to be prepared for everything. And it just takes a certain type of individual to do these things that my father was doing, and he passed that down to me, right?
Yeah.
So it was
another thing your father did. I mean, this is kind of ties in with the thing about the why isn't the gate on the other side of the glass? And that is, you have a vault with safes in it, and it's an impregnable vault. It's this, it's that. But your father just goes, no, so what's underneath the vault? Another
what's
business?
On the side of it. Yeah.
What's in the bottom?
Perfect.
So instead of trying to break into the vault, you just open up the floor underneath and go inside.
Easy. Easy, easy like cake. And he figured it out. And the first time was when they penetrated a vault, probably early 70s. He got upset because he couldn't, they couldn't open the door, you know, the vault door. He got so upset that he threw this 15-pound mallet, this hammer, you know, the sledgehammer. He threw it, and it went right through the vault. It was a soft vault. It was made out of sheetrock. It was so big.
It looked and good. It looked very convincing with a big door on it. But the it could have, like, paper mache.
I mean, like a big, you know, like a monster vault, you know, like with, shoot, like a bank vault. Like, you know, 20, 25 inches thick. I mean, something enormous. And they're going at the door, and you see he got so upset that he threw the hammer, and it just went right through. And he was like, what the? They looked at each other, and they couldn't believe it. That was one of the biggest heists that they pulled at that time. And at that time, my father was, he was extremely, very wealthy. But not only from that, anything in legitimate business, in the construction business, in the restaurant business, he was successful, whatever he did. So his money was mixed up. You know, with the illegal and the legal, everything was mixed up, but he always made sure that he had a job, he paid taxes, and this was under the supervision and advice of his lawyer, David Linetsky, Sr. And this was like the concierge of my father. And he told them exactly what to do and how to do it and not to do certain things because it would turn into more time according to law. You know, like if you have a gun on you while you're doing, you know, you know, you're turning it into a nightmare, into a 15-year crime. So that's why my father was extremely adamant about me not carrying a firearm, a gun. And I was like Tommy Two Guns in New York. I loved guns. I mean, I was addicted to guns, you know, because I was, I wanted to be a gangster. Well, I was a gangster. And, you know, this is just the lifestyle that we were living, you know, because I needed to protect myself. I had a lot of money on me at all times, you know. So I was a target. I was a target to get robbed. I was a target to get kidnapped. I was a target by the Italians, by the Albanians, by anybody. Whoever was working with us or around us or whatever, you know, I was a son of a prominent gangster in Manhattan. You know, so I was worth something. And you've seen that I did get kidnapped. I mean, it did happen. So, you know, that's all the proof you really need, you know?
Yeah, well, your kidnap story, which you you told us several months ago, and of course, probably a lot of people listening today didn't hear that, or you know, nowhere to find it. But when you were kidnapped,
they will. They will not. You know what? Soon, I'm very positive that all these stories are going to come to light because, you know, they're based on one fact, which is the truth.
When you were kidnapped, not only were you just kidnapped, you weren't like kidnapped and held for ransom. You were kidnapped, shot up on drugs, wrapped up in duct tape, stuck in a bathtub for 3 days while they robbed your home, robbed your business, robbed your father's business, and millions
pockets,
and millions.
Everything. They took everything from me. Yeah, everything. Yeah, sure. It was horrible. It was bad to be in that situation, and I'm only 22 years old, you know. And I'm thinking this is the end of my life. This is it. Like, it's going to end like this, you know. Seriously, that's, you know, they had plastic on the floor and everything. Like, they were ready. They're ready to chop me up. They had hacksaws and everything. Like, you know, they would have got an Academy Award for it. No, it wasn't true. Because it was so real to me. I was like, you know, and they got my partner, my buddy in the trunk already. He's half dead. You know, they're going to hack him up later. And, you know, we're dealing with assassins over here. We're dealing with people that don't mind blood, that don't mind guts. They'll take off all their clothes and they'll go naked in the bathtub and hack me up into bits, you know, so they could transport me easier in Ziploc bags. I mean, that's what they do.
So you must have figured your life was over.
I swear to God, on everything that I love, I was saying prayers that I didn't even know existed. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I was saying, Christian, Catholic prayers, everything. Like, I was Adonai, all that, everything. I mean, I was speaking in tongues, okay?
I bet you were.
Trying to communicate with God so this doesn't happen. So my life does not end in Ziploc bags, okay? In some crappy place in New Jersey somewhere after a heist, after I just pulled a heist. You know, after I'm helping somebody get on their feet, you know, because they came to me to ask me, please, we need to make money. Can you please help us? We're willing to do whatever. You know, and I'm like, all right, fine. You know, they come from my country. You know, they're young also. Let me make them more money than they ever made in their life. But what they did was they had it pre-planned with one of my enemies, which is my father's greatest enemy, and only enemy, really. And that's Mooma, right?
Did he become your enemy because he was your father's enemy?
He became our enemy together at the same time, because if he violated my father, he violated me. It doesn't matter. He was my enemy also. But somehow, some way, he got me out of my father's hands because he was speaking bad, you know, about my father to me, like, oh, your father's stealing all your money. It's you. You're doing everything. And I'm young, so I'm eating all this up, you know. And, you know, he's giving me this extra courage I need to fight my father. So my father becomes like my enemy for how long it was, a year and a half or 2 years that I was rolling with these guys. And these guys, they were a bad bunch of people. I mean, a very bad bunch of people. They weren't...
They weren't gentlemen thieves.
And your father couldn't talk you...
They weren't nonviolent. Okay?
Your father couldn't talk you away from them?
I didn't talk. My father and I, we had a big argument and fight, and we don't talk. So we're enemies now, you know? So I'm working with one of his former students, now enemy, and it's the Serbian Mafia, you know? So I'm here doing heists with them, and the last conversation that I had with my father was, at this time, was he said that, listen, if you keep on doing what you're doing, you're going to wind up in the joint, in the can. And that's exactly what happened. I wound up in prison because of the acts that I was doing with them. And I was arrested for one of the largest watch heists in the history of the world, which was the Miracle Watch Company, and that was in the Diamond District. And I was caught red-handed in the Diamond District. And this was a front page. This was a front page article, and it was a serious affair. because they never caught anyone ever on 47th Street in the Diamond District robbing, you know, or stealing, because they didn't know who we were. So once they got me, and they got another gentleman that his brother was a famous aviation pilot for NYPD, a guy that drives the mayor around. But, you know, this guy's his brother that bailed him out. So it was a big deal. You know, so you have me, David Sanchez, and Vato Kadovic. And his brother is one of the first notable Pink Panthers in Manhattan that was doing all the windows in the Trump and Tiffany and, you know, all those storefronts. He's the first guy to do that. But he's no longer with us. A lot of guys passed away. There's maybe three people left. Three original people left in the whole entire crew.
And well, miracle watch company where you got busted. I've read a lot about that. We've been talked to you a lot about that, you know, privately. You violated one of your own rules, and also there was someone else screwed up. The rule you violated was you don't go back in. Once you're out, you're out. You don't go back in. Yeah. You went back in.
Yeah, for some reason, criminals, they like to come back to the scene, you know? Or, you know, for some reason, this is just a unwritten rule. If something happens, they want to come back and see what's happening, you know? And that's not cool. Because, you know, the police and FBI, they got intelligent enough to know that they take pictures, of people after the scenes, and they investigate those people that are actually there because they know how high the percentage is that the actual convict or criminal was, you know,
returned to the scene of the crime.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so like, you know, 9 out of 10, they'll find them right there after to see what's going on. I didn't return for that reason. I returned because one of the bags was flipped upside down, and the handles were inside, so you couldn't take the bag because it was very heavy. It had probably like around 1,300 watches, you know, in his bag, in his duffel bag, and it was one of the better batches, you know, of watches, the more expensive ones. And then I opened the vault. I didn't even know the guy had a vault. You know, I found it.
A vault. As long as it's here, I'll open it.
Well, I seen the vault, you know, in the back. I didn't even know he had one, and I opened it, and I didn't finish taking everything out of it. So that was another reason why I wanted to go back, because I only took like 30-40% of it, you know, and I left 60% intact, and I wanted to come back and take everything.
Meanwhile, your lookout goes for a walk.
Yeah, well, he was in a car. Usually we worked in, like, undercover cop cars, you know, or taxis or something, or limos. I was known for doing a lot of heists with limos. But he was in, like, undercover, you know, like a LTD, you know, yeah, one of those cars, and he went around the block. He figured he wasn't needed there, you know, in front of the place. The address was 48 West 48th Street. Between 5th and 6th Avenue. And that's in the Diamond District. And funny thing, Alex Gerbat, the moth, right? He goes there the next day because he had a watch that he was selling him or buying or something. He had some business. And the guy says, you know, your picture was the first picture that the NYPD, that the Major K Squad, the detective showed me. Of him, you know, and he said, you know, I didn't say anything about you, but I know you know exactly where my watches are, you know. So, you know, better than me. That's what he told Alex.
Oh boy!
And Alex walked out of there like, oh my god, like, you know, this job was never supposed to take, it was never supposed to happen because he used to buy stolen stuff from us all the time. This guy, you know, and when I went over with MoMA and his crew. He was like, hey, you know, have any good jobs? And I just was on a job today, you know, that I know that, you know, they put like, you know, 20, 30 Cartier watches and Rolexes. I know he put it on top of the safe, you know, and we got those watches. So it was a huge job. It was a big job because I went back. And you're right. I should have never went back. But I was young, dumb. And that's what young, dumb criminals do, you know? So I went back with a new, fresh crew because the first two guys I went in was Bobby MoMA, right? And I think Zoran.
Yeah, Zoran Jasek, who's currently in MoMA, Peru.
If I'm correct. Those two. And they got tired. They don't want to go back because, you know, you have to climb a lot of fire escapes. And it's you know, you need to be very fit running around there. And, you know, back then they didn't have this this thing called parkour. You know, this, you know, where they jump from building to building?
Yeah.
They do it in France. It's like a sport already.
Yeah.
But we were doing that back then, you know, in the, you know, through these backyards. You know, that's how we were running through there because we knew every angle and it was just impossible for them to catch us. Yeah, it was, it's an amazing story. Amazing story.
But they did catch you because you went back in and the lookout wasn't looking out. The cops show up, right. And they're in the same building as you.
Yeah. So when we went around the block, there was two cops that were dispatched because there was a janitor in the building, and when he got to a specific floor that we went into, that we went in through, he opened the female bathroom, right, and there was a huge hole leading to the rooftop. And he didn't see us because we were upstairs in Miracle Watch Company. So, but he reported it. So he called, you know, 911, and the cops came. And the cops, they didn't know where we were at, but we needed to leave that way. So when we came back down from the 7th floor to the 5th floor, or it was like the 9th floor to the 7th floor, one of those, but it was only like 2-3 floors up. When we got to that floor, there were three cops there with their guns drawn, and I had a mask on, a Halloween mask, and so did everybody else, and a tracksuit. And the cop later told me, said, "You know what? I remember your mask and your tracksuit. Well, I remember your tracksuit." He said he was going to shoot me.
Oh, great!
Lucky, like, and I'm lucky that he didn't shoot me because he was scared. You know, he's seen, you know, three guys coming. You know, we open the door, and there's cops there holding their guns, and they don't know where we are. And we just show up on them, and we pop up on them. I didn't know there was cops there.
So David Sanchez throws a bag of watches at him.
Yeah, so David, that was on top of me, he threw a bag of, you know, heavy watches on top of the cop. And the door closed. I went downstairs. We, like, separated, you know. We went separate ways. One guy was with me. Bato was with me. And they found me, like, 4 hours later, you know, because now they pulled the pins. They called the SWAT team, emergency service units. Oh, they called everybody. Helicopters were flying in the air because now they've seen us, you know. They actually seen us for the first time. And it was a big deal, man, huge deal. They dispatched the dogs, and that's basically how they found us because, I ran out of, pepper that I had. You know, I had a special blend of pepper that we used to use for the dogs. As soon as the dog, you know, gets a whiff of it, he's going to be indisposed. He's not going to be able to smell anything anymore, you know, for a while.
So you ran out of pepper and the dog found you, hiding in the closet.
Yeah, it found me in the closet with this guy. He was like 6'7". He's very tall. And they stick the dog on him. It was a big affair. It was on the front page of the newspapers. You know, it was a big deal. And I got busted on 47th Street in the Diamond District twice in my life.
That's two times more than you need.
You know? Well, for the story, I mean, for the story, to authenticate the story, that this is what I'm telling you, guys. I was arrested twice during a commission of a crime, you know, nighttime, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning in the Diamond District. I'm not supposed to be there, right?
That's right.
There you go. But we were supposed to be there. Why? Because my father and my lovely, beautiful mother had 4 or 5 working companies which I was the vice president of one of them, which was Gemstones Trading Gallery International. And this was located smack middle of the Diamond District in Manhattan. I mean, couldn't be more in the middle than we were. We were right in the middle of the wealthiest street of the world at one point. This place was occupied by every factory, by every diamond corporation, by every diamond cutter, by every diamond distributor, by every gemstone dealer. And this is what we did legitimately. We were earning a lot of money legitimately, paying off taxes and the rents. We were never late. We never filed for Chapter 11. We never were on welfare. Always working, maintaining employment and always owning something like a company or something like that and property. So that illusion, that image that my father portrayed was almost impenetrable, because who'd go against that? He has lawyers, he has good advice, they can't catch the guy,
It's amazing.
It was extremely weird when I was arrested inside the office. That was the third arrest. When I was inside the company, and I walked past the two detectives that came out of the building that we're in, the main building, 45 West 47th Street, and I tell my friend Mike, I'm like, hey, those guys are cops, 100%. And I went up to my father, and I said, hey, I just bumped into two cops. And all of a sudden, after a couple of seconds, they're kicking the door down and pulling their pistols out to arrest me on a warrant, because the whole entire time that I was stealing in New York City from 1990 to 1994, I was wanted on warrants. I had like 3-4 warrants. And I was always on the run the whole entire time. Every time I maintained, I had an apartment, I was living in hotels, the best hotels, and I was living the life, man, like a playboy, like a rock star, nightclubs every night, and the nightclubs that everybody goes to. So, Monday night, China Club, I'm there, the night that you're supposed to be there, I'm there, wearing Versace shirts, Hermes shirts, and I just did the heist, and nobody's arresting me, so it was very weird. In a way.
Well, also, there was a time of extreme corruption in the NYPD at that time. I mean, your dad was obviously protected, because you got one group of cops with a major case squad. They're trying to bust whoever is doing this. But your dad was protected.
Right? Columbus Cafe, this place called China Club.
Yeah.
The guy that's working the door, China Club Dave, he's an NYPD cop, and I'm giving him a Versace shirt, and a line of blow. You know what I mean? Those were the days. And he lets me in, and then five, six of my friends, all guys. You're not supposed to let guys in like that, I mean, one friend, yeah. There's five, six guys. You don't let guys in a club like that unless they have women with them. And I got VIP treatment anywhere in New York. Why? Well, partially because of my father, partially because of Bosco, partially because of me, So it was like a trifecta, because I left my father, I made a name for myself, and then I came back even stronger because I had the entire security company that were securing all these diamond corporations in my back pocket. I brought him one of the main managers to his house, and that's how I got back in with my father. That's how I got back good in with my father. And that's when the story really starts. Because that's when we started banging out these heists that were $100 million and better. I just wish I had 1% of that money that we stole back then. Because
I wish you did, too.
it's sensational. The money aspect, it's in the billions, if you want to get technical. When you put Alex's and my heist together, because those are my father's heists, so basically if you take his heist, those are like taking my father's, and then all of my heists. And you put all that together, we're talking about 50 years worth of stealing in Manhattan. And these are all high-end jewelry manufacturers. Jagger LeCoultre, the watchmaker, we did them first. We did them in the 80s, in 1986, when I was in Switzerland. They already did Jagger LeCoultre. And nobody heard of them till now. Because they, you know why? Because they got hit in the 1980s and they didn't have any product to show because we had it all. You know?
That's too bad.
I'm not joking. I'm not joking. I'm telling you the truth here. Jagger LeCoultre. Jagger, this is a huge name in watches, much bigger and better. Like, it's like, it's much, much stronger than Rolex, you know?
Hey, speaking of Rolex, at one time, your dad was selected to be like head of Rolex International.
One time only? Really? Only one time? Yes. Yes, bro. One time. You're right. And that's because of the mob, you see? The Italian mob, La Cosa Nostra,
yeah.
They elected my father, Mr. Stan, because he was such a prestigious, generous, courteous businessman that didn't, you know, that kept his business to himself. Yeah, they elected him to become the president for the whole entire United States for Rolex, meaning any Rolex that comes from Switzerland, Geneva, goes to my father first, goes through us. And we're the ones that set the prices for American standards. Yeah, that's true. That's something. Because at that time, he was getting like presidents for like $3,000-$4,000 back then with the box and everything, you know. So they were going for $20,000-$30,000 here.
Yeah, Mark Boyer, our fact checker, was just looking up the prices on some of these Rolex watches.
Oh, the Jaggers.
Yeah. Yeah, Jagger LeCoultre. There's watches that cost $200,000-$300,000. And one of the watches that I had was the 150th anniversary for the Jagger LeCoultre company. And this was probably going to one of the highest executives. And this is the watch that I had. And I sold it, and I stole it back, and I gave it back to my father. But it was a Moonface chronograph. Only one made.
You know, I was thinking of your father this week, and his name is Mr. Stan.
Yeah, Mr. Stan. Yeah,
yeah, but that's not his name, right?
His name is Vojislav Stanimirovich. So they call him Mr. Stan for short, for Stanimirovich, because Stanimirovich is such a long name. It's 12 letters, and it's almost impossible to pronounce unless you come from that area. So that's why they call him Mr. Stan.
Got it.
No, that's not his name. That's not his real name.
But easy enough to figure out how that happened. Okay.
Yeah, and then his construction company had Stan Construction, Stanley Painting Company, Stanley Construction. So, you know, he also used that Stanley for that, for the construction in Manhattan that he used to do. And he was one of the largest contractors because he worked with Tishman and, you know, with big... like Herbert Contracting, you know. And the story goes even further because I know of this. When I was with that other crew, I was collecting money for the Serbian mob, and they owned Hawk and Marine Contracts based out of Teaneck, New Jersey. And this was huge because I was collecting, you know, $200,000-$300,000 every week payroll for the construction companies, and we had asbestos companies. I mean, we had so many legitimate companies that we could have funneled our money through. We had parking lots, we had jewelry stores, we had restaurants, we had nightclubs. You know, I was the one with the nightclubs because I liked nightclub business. I was a kid, you know.
But you were only in your early 20s when all this was going on.
Yeah, I was, when I first got arrested and I had to do the 7-8 years, my first bid was 1994. And I was only 24 years old, okay? So when I got arrested, and I wasn't even supposed to do time upstate. I had such good lawyers. But I made I did some tomfoolery, you know, because during the time that I was out on bail, I had guns on me. But you could understand, Burl could understand why I had guns on me, because I had people chasing me. I had enemies, and am I correct?
Yes, and it's amazing. There was one fellow, the boxer, the guy who Had his ear chopped off.
Yeah. Saba the Boxer. Yes.
He was murdered about 1 minute after you left his place.
As soon as I left, he got murdered. And you know who he is? He's Leonard Spinks' sparring partner. Lifetime sparring partner. There you go. That's who he is. I just found out. Spinks?
Say that again. Leon Spinks?
Wait, hold on a second. Sugar Ray. I don't know now if it's Sugar Ray or Leon or Spinks. Oh, man. I'm not into that. Either Sugar Ray Leonard or Spinks.
How big a guy was he?
He was like 154, 160, like that.
Sugar Ray.
Sugar Ray. Probably Sugar Ray. Yeah, Sugar Ray. Yeah, probably for Sugar Ray. Because he was his sparring partner. And his name is Sava. They call him Serbian Sava. He's very well known. And he had his ear chopped off by a Serbian... one of those Archon guys, you know, the White Tigers.
And, yeah, I guess because he was poking the guy's wife.
Yeah, he shouldn't have been doing that. But the guy was, you know, fighting a war, and while the guy was fighting a war, this guy's a commando. You know, you don't want to mess with somebody like that, with his wife. So this commando, instead of killing him because he had his .45 in his mouth, he cuts his ear off and he throws his ear away. And I remember MoMA, me, Milita, that's my construction, we're rushing Sava to the hospital. So we take him to ear, nose, and throat in New York, which is the first time they ever reconnected an ear, you know, like this, on somebody's head. So this is like a first-time thing, you know, so it was a big deal. And this was around that time when we were trying to kidnap the kid that was kidnapped by the Moonies, by that cult.
Yeah.
Well, it's around that same time, because we were all together at that time. But, yeah. So, lesson number one, don't ever mess with a commando's wife.
Yeah.
I'll write that down.
Write that down, Howard.
While he's fighting a war, all right? And number two, never come back to a place of a crime.
Never return to the scene of the crime and don't poke a tiger's wife.
Never. Just don't do it. Don't come back. Just don't, you know, just don't do it, because, listen, I came back and this is what threw me in a pit of misery, because I wound up doing 16 years out of my life in incarcerated in prison. And
how did they catch you when you went back? I mean, what did you do? How did you give yourself up?
That was the...
Oh, I didn't give myself up. Right? They found me. I was in between the walls. You know, I was hiding because the police didn't know where we were at. And they had the SWAT team there. So they were going from each floor. They were banging all the doors open. And they were, you know, they were breaking into places like closets and things. But I was hiding fully on the sixth floor. Now, mind you, the job took place like on the seventh or ninth floor, you know, and I'm down on the first floor where the police are coming in and out, and they don't know I'm right there in front of the closet. Like, I was home free. You know, they would have never thought about that. Just at the end, the dog was the one that found me, because there was the last, you know, they were the last to walk out, and the dog started going crazy under the door. And I just opened the door, you know, because they had M16s and stuff. You know, this is an emergency service unit, SWAT team. You don't want to mess with these guys. You know, if they see something shiny, they're going to light me up. And they're very nervous. So I said, listen, I have no weapons. I'm going to open the door. There's two of us in here. And when the fellow that was with me, when he came out, he's like 6'7". So he's tall. And they sick the dog on him because they got so scared. You know, that's how big this guy comes out, 6'7", and he comes out of a closet. Like, you know. So it was just, it wasn't comical or anything like that. It was just very realistic, you know. People panic, you know. They have their finger on the trigger, and they don't know what they're dealing with, all right? So, I mean, I wanted to come out there alive.
Yeah, good thinking. Now, they take you down to the precinct and put you on display like it's Planet of the Apes.
Exactly like the Planet of the Apes. If there was a better analogy to find, there isn't. Because the three of us, we were displayed, and every precinct in Manhattan came, and Brooklyn, and all over, FBI, they came to see us. And they're like, hey, what time is it, guys? Not asking us what time it was. You know, 5,000 watches stolen. Meanwhile, these guys, they were going through the watches right in front of us. Hey, Sarge, which one you want? You know, and they were just pocketing. I think each cop that came in there took 2-3 watches with them. And by the time they went to court, there was only, I don't know, 300 watches or something, you know? So they were like, well, where's the watch? You caught the guys.
Where are the watches?
Where's the watches? You know, like, so it was, there was not even a case. You know, they messed up big time. It was just, nobody fights cases in New York, first of all right? There's no real criminals, all right? I mean, unless you wanted to talk about the mob. But the mob, they don't really do heists like the way we do heists. We do this 24/7, 365 days a year. They do it once a year, maybe. You know what I mean? And they'll do it with one of us. So, you know, if there's something big, and they come, you know, strapped with guns, and they're prepared to kill people. They're prepared to, you know, to close down highways and streets. They don't care. You know, I mean, they're, you know, this is what they do.
When you partner with those guys, how do you whack up the money?
Well, basically, how do we do it?
Yeah.
Well, I keep it for myself, and I just whack everybody else off. I just kill everybody.
You know? No, you're not supposed to do that.
That's basically what I do. You know? In my head. You know, because I can't believe I'm giving people $500,000 each, you know. But, yeah, I split it equally. Everybody has their job, and everybody gets equal pay. But there's perks that come with the job. Like, for example, I'm the guy that goes in, right?
Right.
The guy that opens the safe. So I'm the guy that sees the diamonds first. I'm the guy that touches the diamonds. I'm the guy that packs the diamonds up. So I have sticky fingers because I want to get my cut off the rip, you know? I want to have mine right there. You know, that's just me. And I might split that with my father. I might not. You know, it depends how I feel that day. You know, if I feel generous or not. Or the person that's with me, you know, I always get something extra. But normally, we split it like a pizza pie. Everybody gets an equal share, you know? Because we expect everybody's job, it doesn't matter if you're a lookout. And we do a nice heist, and you're going to get a chunk, a $200,000 chunk. You're going to get as much as I'm going to get, you know, and everybody else, because you're going to do your job better than anybody else. You get it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, people play their position here, and you can't have any loose links because we're going fast here, all right? And if you're going fast, you know, you can't have any loose links. You got to change these links and put strong people in place, people that are so strong that if they get in trouble and they get arrested, they're going to keep their mouth shut, and there's going to be a lawyer that's going to be sent, that's paid with bail money to bail this person out if they're on our team. You see how fair we are? Who does that? Nobody. You see, that's showing love. Because out of every heist that we do, we put money in a kitty. You know, like if there's five of us, well, a sixth part goes into a kitty, and that's for, like, the rent a car, for the tools, for the hotel rooms, for whatever is needed, for food, you know, whatever, expenses. That's an expense account. And this is ran like a business. And we stay together until the job is finished, meaning we're going to stay together 4 or 5 days, 6 days, 7, you know, maybe more. It all depends until it's finished, until it's sold, you know. So, and this is why Mr. Stan always had mansions, always big houses with a lot of bedrooms, you know, because it didn't make sense. It was just him, my mother, and me. And he has a 6-bedroom, 5-bathroom house. Like, I mean, you know, right? So, you know.
So that's so the crew can stay there until everything's all over with.
What was that?
So that's so the crew could stay there till everything's over with.
Exactly, yeah. And the buyers would come there, you know, like the buyers that we had on 47th Street, like Hitler, one of those guys, Benny. They would come, and they would bring cash. You know, they would bring $100,000, $200,000, and then they would come back again. and then some stuff would be brought to Manhattan, but, you know, back and forth, whatever. But a lot of times it would come to the house in Long Island, you know. That was nice. It was already set up, you know. It was just very, no one would know. The neighbor across the street, he was a mobster. Like, you know, like everything was so secluded and set up, and we were so safe, you know. And you're right. Yeah, he had authorities working for them, you know. Because he had a lot of mob clout.
Well, yeah, you told me one time that you were out to dinner with your dad, and the chief of police comes over and buys him a drink and says hi to him.
Yeah, of course. Like, you know, things like that. You know, like, they have, there's a chief of police in Manhattan that was around that same precinct, I think 72nd. I forgot what precinct it is. I don't want to say the wrong precinct, but up there by 85th and Columbus, where we had Panarello's restaurant. And we helped him open a Chinese restaurant, you know?
Mm. Well, listen.
With construction, with money, with whatever's needed.
Hey, punch.
We just about run out of time. Another hour that just zipped by. Fascinating stuff. Hope to have you back again soon. Thanks a lot.
Take care, Punch.
Thank you, man. Thank
all right.
You.
Bye. All right.
What a life.
There's something else.
Amazing stuff.
Hey, bro.
Yeah.
What's next?
Magic, Matt Allen, and the Demons of Taking Us live from the Light of Lounge at OliveRadioLive.com.